You're listening to Visionaries by Wonder, a podcast where CEOs, founders, and leaders share their success stories with their host, Jeannie O, the founder of Wonder and an award-winning product strategy and UX design firm. We'll be exploring the world and connecting with inspiring individuals. Join us.
Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with John Hernandez, the founder and CEO of Dash 2 Labs. With a wealth of experience in leadership positions, managing multi-million dollar programs, including nuclear weapon modernization, production, and unmanned aerial system production and global operations, John is a true innovator in the world of artificial intelligence and project management. As a former U.S. Navy pilot, systems engineer, and program manager, John brings a unique perspective to his work. He has earned multiple U.S. Navy Innovation Awards and even has a U.S. patent for novel military technology development. With certifications as both a project management professional and Lean Six Sigma Black Belt, John is a master of his craft. Behind Dash 2 Labs, John and his team are developing an artificial intelligence-based project management assistant, providing multi-source data integration, broad situational awareness, and rapid problem resolution. Join us as we sit down with John Hernandez to discuss his career and the exciting work he's doing at Dash 2 Labs. John, welcome to the show.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me. Real happy to be here.
Happy to have you here as well. So, John, how did you get to where you are today? Give us a quick elevator pitch of who you are.
I think something that usually comes up is, how did I get into tech? I think I could trace that all the way back to when I was around 14, 15 and started working summers as an HVAC technician. And you started to realize the power of mathematics had on reality instead of just like being a classroom exercise. So this got me interested in engineering and such. And so I decided to go off and I studied engineering physics. And then after that, took a job in government managing of all things parks and recreation and operations and engineering. And concurrently got a master's degree in physics in space magnetohydrodynamics. So I had been a pilot since I was about 16. So I decided, why not go for the space program in the U.S. Navy? So I signed up to be a pilot in the Navy a little later when I was about 26. And I was actually working as an applied physicist at that time. So long story short, I was in the Navy for about just over a decade. I think you had mentioned that. Various roles, systems engineer, pilot, lots of innovation and such, had a great time, had a chance to get a master's degree in systems engineering as well. But got out after my pilot contract, went over to MIT as a Sloan Fellow and got my MBA, and then bridged over into the private sector, working for General Atomics, Los Alamos National Labs, and now here I am. So.
Wow. So you're definitely one of those students that actually took mathematics and made it into a career. Mm-hmm. Most kids are like, you know, I don't understand why we have to learn calculus, but it sounds like you actually took it to use.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the biggest trends that we're seeing right now is that the power of data, it's almost the new oil, right? I mean, that's a lot. Yeah. All of it is driving artificial intelligence, machine learning and such. And you had mentioned calculus. And I really think long term, a lot of that is going to be completely phased out with automation and such. I mean, just look at ChatGPT as an example.
Oh, yeah.
But going back to just basic data analytics, understanding data structures, matrix algebra and things like that, I think it's just going to be very powerful in every single industry. And so, yeah, it is. if any kids are listening, at least take that and then bridge that over and really study hard on that. So,
yeah. But what about adults, right? Like, what about people who are already has their career? What advice would you give them on how to incorporate more data into what they're working on?
So it depends on each role, right? So it could be a C-suite executive or a senior, even a mid-level manager, even a person who just started. Each strata would has different avenues to take. One of which is, if you're a manager, let's face it, there's tons of smart folks out there. I think one of the biggest things is to realize, look, build yourself a really good team that fills in the gaps that you're weak on. And I think that's just a general practice that should be looked at. There's also like educational executive programs. I'm a little biased here. I'm going to say MIT is a really good offering. They have stuff in like high level data analytics for managers and things like that, where they don't go too deep into the mathematics. So you don't have to be like a genius in math like those guys are, but rather they bridge it up to where anyone could understand it gain a good appreciation for it, and then go out into the real world and apply it.
So would you say that you would recommend someone to get into an MBA program to learn how to apply data into the work that they're doing?
No, I wouldn't say necessarily an MBA program. An MBA, I think the best way to articulate that is there's executive level certificates that they offer. So it's something that you can take over the course of a summer. So maybe if you're working for a big firm that sponsors things like that, that may be an option. But there's also plenty of free options on the internet right now, right? There's LinkedIn, there's Coursera, there's Udemy, where you can have some really good folks to teach you the basics and high level of how to apply it. So I think there's plenty of options out there.
Yeah, it's just about how willing you are to take that free information and have the free education, right? I think there's just, as you said, so much to learn from the internet.
Right.
Okay. I was going to say, you've been in the military space for over a decade. Tell us what your journey has been like innovating within that environment.
Yeah. So I think my wife calls it a popcorn brain. She calls it a popcorn brain because I love immersing myself in things, in situations, environments, activities. And I honestly think that's the best way to really understand if you're trying to innovate within a space. Go out there and really experience it, not necessarily in a lab or at home or whatever the case is, and innovating effectively in a silo. But getting back to your question of as far as like innovation within the military space, I mean, I can share a couple stories. One story that eventually evolved in me and a co-inventor getting a patent in military technology, as you had mentioned. I was working in a what's called a SCIF environment. I mean, I can't talk too much about it, but it's basically a classified environment. And I saw the way the acoustic analysts were doing the work, and it was very manual. So what that kind of popped in my brain was, look, there's a lot of room for error. It's taking them a long time. It's very inefficient. So I ended up developing an Excel-based prototype directly working with these analysts over the course of, I think it was about 4 months. And afterwards, it was all about iteration. So I was basically taking their requirements and then building it into this, I would say, very primitive prototype at that time in Excel-based. So what ended up happening was they were like, look, this is fantastic. We can use this. And then my next set of orders was to the Naval Postgraduate School, getting a master's degree in systems engineering. And I figured, why not take this concept, bridge it over, and look at full automation with this process? So we ended up doing that. I partnered with a friend of mine that I had met at the school. And we ended up building out a full autonomous system for what those folks were doing, which, long story short, eventually ended up getting patented. So that's So that was a lot of fun.
So was the patent on the process itself or the automation tool?
It was in algorithms. So that's effectively, I can't name any names specifically, but. Sure. We ended up presenting our research at a conference, and a large aerospace defense industry expressed some interest in it. So I did some Navy sanctioned consulting with them, and they expressed a lot of interest in the algorithms on effectively not using what the software we use, which is MATLAB. It's a very engineering-based system. They were interested in just taking the algorithms and then recoding it in Java. So at that point, the Navy's like, look, we need to get a patent on this thing. So they kind of move forward with the process. So that's how that happened.
Gotcha. That is so cool because you don't really hear about people patenting algorithms, right? You usually hear people patenting like physical products. And so let's dive into that a little bit more. Like, what does it mean to patent an algorithm? And does that patent actually, is that patent owned by you or does that ultimately go to the U.S. Navy because that's where you were at the time when you developed this?
That's exactly right. We had some of the patent attorneys reach out to us and say, hey, look, just so you're aware of it, you're developing on Navy time, Navy technology, Navy computers. It belongs completely to us. Luckily, both our names are on the patent. It's, what is it called? Method and Apparatus for Rapid Acoustic Analysis is the name of the patent. So it's like a patent.
It's a mouthful, yeah.
I know, it's definitely a mouthful, But yeah, they actually do. The Navy does own the patent, and we just have our name on it. We got a few awards for it, but that's about it.
Gotcha. Just a few awards, right? That sounds awesome. So how does someone go about patenting an algorithm? Like, let's say we develop a software for, like pet sitting, right? Like, how can I go and patent that algorithm, or how does that work?
That's going to be a question for a patent attorney. In fact, I'm in talks with patent attorneys now. One piece of advice that I can offer, which is very high level for innovators out there, is we use a systems engineering process. And I think that goes into a lot of the way I approach design thinking. With systems engineering processes, you're inevitably going to develop systems engineering documents. So functional flow block diagrams, architectures, mapping the requirements, design synthesis, analysis of alternatives. And I'll get into all that fancy jargon in a minute. Mm-hmm. But with this documentation, with the patent attorneys I've talked to for my current project, they said, look, take that exact same approach, hand us these documents, and it can cut the cost and cut the time that we have to spend in evaluating your idea. As far as the process itself, I don't know. We talked to plenty of patent attorneys during the process. I know they effectively go through all your technical documentation and try to bridge the tech talk over to something that can be put inside of a patent. So,
gotcha. Okay, interesting. So your advice is to always document your system so that it's easier for when you do patent that the lawyers can understand your process and put that into their own jargon, basically.
Exactly. Otherwise, it's just going to be a lot of iteration. And iteration in a lawyer. I'm making fun. My dad was a lawyer. My best friend's a lawyer. It's basically more billable hours. So I think the more information you can provide up front, the less questions they'll have on the back end and less cost for you. So
Gotcha. And I want to get us back to when you were talking about the Excel prototype, because what was really interesting for me was to hear that, like, you built out a prototype within Excel, right? And a lot of, I think, innovators, entrepreneurs, startup founders, they're always so concerned about building out this, you know, full-blown prototype that has all the functionalities. So it was intriguing to me to hear that, like, you did something really simple on an Excel. Can you expand on that a little bit more? Why you felt that it was really important to start there?
Yeah. So at the time, I had my own way of thinking, but I'll have to admit, I was more of a physicist mindset at the time. So I was very solution focused. So I kind of stumbled into this design process, which eventually kind of got me going on where I am today in my design processes. But something that's absolutely critical in any design process is starting with the human, starting with people. If you identify a need, then that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone needs it, so to say, especially if you're looking at building a business. If you're going to do it as a hobby, cool. You know, let's go forward and conquer. But on the back end, if you're looking at actually taking this thing to market, I think it's a very fine balance with business and tech development. And that kind of gets into the word of innovation. Like, what exactly does that mean? It's been a few years, but MIT's version of innovation is commercialization, the product of commercialization and invention. So invention would be, okay, some guy in a, you know, laboratory developing technology, but not necessarily looking at the market effects, total addressable markets, segments, personnel, things like that. And then, of course, commercialization is the business side of it. So I think it's the fine balance between those two. But getting back to your question of, I think what you're getting at is a minimum viable product, right? So without building out a full product, especially startup world, I mean, I'm relatively new to it, and it's very much, you have to be very cognizant of your runway. So it's capital and time.
Yeah.
And what minimum viable products do is it provides you something to get on the market, start talking to people, start getting iterative feedback on it. And I think one of the biggest questions is, are you providing value? And is the customer willing to pay for that value? I think that's very important. But before getting to that point, in a real MVP, in my opinion, there's a ton of diligence that needs to be done up front to minimize the risk of product market fit on the back end.
Yeah, I just want to like highlight what you just shared and like replay that video to like all of our potential clients who, you know, our startup potential clients who are like, hey, can you build me this product? And, you know, we have a very limited budget and time, but we want to put in all the bells and whistles. And what you just shared is exactly our approach to innovation as well, which is you got to provide value, right? And make it as simple as possible, test it out to the market and see if people are willing to pay for that value. And so often, I think a lot of people are very focused on their vision and what they want to build out, that they often forget that you need to have a market for the vision that you're trying to execute on. Right. So I thought your point was like right on.
Yeah, it's absolutely 100% agree with that. So yeah, I'm a very systematic thinker. So I'll go through very systematic processes before I start anything. So, but yeah, sorry, kind of went off on a tangent there.
No, I love it. I love it. That's, you know, that's how we go on this podcast. And tell us about the process of like identifying a need. You know, how do you know there's a need for innovation and iterating to a patented solution for autonomous undersea object identification?
Yeah, it starts with getting out there. I mean, there's different methodologies, right? You get like Lean Six Sigma, you have systems engineering, you have conventional project management. All of them are different methodologies of effectively saying the exact same thing, for at least generally speaking. There's voice of the customer, there's Gemba, there's stakeholder analysis, all the same thing effectively. So get out there, talk to people, immerse yourself in the environment in which you're trying to innovate in. Something I would recommend, highly recommend, is if you're not innovating in a space that you're not an expert in, then bring in a team member that is an expert. And what that does is it cuts your time to getting to the point where, okay, I'm fully understanding what's going on here. And a lot of it is going to be talking to people. So my approach to this is it's not only market surveys. I think market surveys are fine, but I by no means think that's the only thing that should be done. Interviews with people. And then stratifying the people that you're interviewing, I guess what I'm trying to say there is, if you're looking at project management, how do you stratify that market? It can be in utilities, or it could be aerospace, or it could be shipbuilding, or whatever the case is. And then you can further segment that market into the people that you're interviewing. Level of experience, certain certifications, qualifications, education, even level of seniority within an organization. Each of them are going to have different ways of thinking and different ways of responding. So something I recommend to my teams when we do this is standardize your interview template. So you're not necessarily going out there and robotically asking these one questions, right? Because that just makes people feel uncomfortable. It's more of just letting them talk and letting them, you know, what's it like to be in your shoes? Tell me about your day. And ideally, you can get a transcription of it. If not, take some very detailed notes. So what we do is we did that with about 55 people in our market space. And the different strata, and what we did was we're all quants, my team. So we looked at pain points that kept popping up, and then a Pareto analysis based on that. And this Pareto analysis started to build patterns and emergent effects of how we should start developing our algorithm, or which specific features we should be targeting initially. So getting back to the MVP conversation, what features do you really focus on? Well, at first, you may or may not know, depending on what you're going on. I think the dangerous thing to do is just to build out an MVP. But if you can look at minimizing the risk on the back end, that way, again, it gets back to runway and capital, then you can extract this Pareto analysis, the pain points, and start to build your MVP around that. So at that point, it kind of bridges over. The MVP is providing value, something value that will be paid for. And that's a very important part of that. So,
Yeah, that's right on point. Again, you know, making sure that you're mitigating your risk by testing your ideas and understanding what the pain points are for the market. How do you then balance the mitigating risk and also time, right? Because time could also be risky if you're spending too much time trying to validate your product, talking to too many people. So where is that sweet spot between having enough feedback and understanding enough about your target market and implementing that into your prototype or whatever you're trying to produce?
So I think, at least from an engineering perspective, the hardest part for us, and I may be just generally speaking, but is getting out there and actually doing these interviews. That's the hardest part. Market segmentation, understanding your market, that's very difficult. And unless you're going to pay like $6,000 for like a professional report, a lot of startups can't do that. So what we end up doing is we talk to people, we do market surveys, we go on the internet and try to find commonalities in data, right? So I think it's important to like set a milestone or a timeline on your team and say, look, We're going to do 4 weeks of this or 6 weeks. Sometimes it may take 2 months, but the reason it takes that long is because it's so critically important. Without this information is effectively going to drive your business model. It's going to drive your target, your technical specifications. Everything about it is being predicated on this effectively a Bible of information that you've collected over here. So you can always reach back and then draw from it to help you overcome challenges as you're moving through. But going through this market segmentation, you start to understand like who these people are. Like there may be people that, you know, I look at it as like a vitamin. Sure, people may be interested in paying for a vitamin, but a lot of times they're like, well, you know, I don't really need that vitamin. I'm not going to pay for it. But if it's really affecting someone's back, as an example, like it's a real pain point, that's what you really want to be focusing on. And to fully understand that, you can't get there until you've fully like segmented down to a population that you're going to be initially targeting in business talk, that's your market, right? Then of course, initial model and what's your total addressable market. If you get full market penetration, what's it going to be? Is that an interesting number to investors if that's what you're going for? And so on and so forth. So,
yeah, that's a lot of variables though, right? Because it's like, you have a market segment that you're building an entire product or solution around. And somewhere down the line, when you're expanding, you realize you're serving other markets. And there could be other markets that find your solution much more valuable than your original market. So then at what point do you pivot or stick with your original target market, right? I don't know the answer. I don't know if you do.
I can only just share my opinion on this one, but... part of my process that I evaluate, and it's largely predicated on what the folks at MIT taught us. I mean, it's just, I guess, a plug for Bill Allett. He's fantastic. He runs the Center for Entrepreneurship out there. And part of his process is actually looking on evaluating follow-on markets in addition to your primary beachhead market. So looking at your customers, looking at the next 10 customers, going through and evaluating their characteristics, and of course, looking at as you're executing, getting market traction, how fast is that growing? And always keeping in mind your adjacent market. So I think that goes into your go-to-market strategy. So, you know, as far with my company now, one of the biggest things is how do you get the product out there? What's the biggest awareness? For project managers, since I've been one for 20 plus years and I know it and I know these folks, I know that they're very, let's go to conferences, white talks, or white papers, tech talks. That's the biggest way to get product awareness out there. But if I wasn't, you know, if I wasn't working in this space for so many years and my team wasn't, didn't bring the experience they had, and I hadn't done that work up front, then maybe my strategy would have been a little different and off because I didn't fully understand the persona, so to speak. I don't understand these people that well. And I think that's a big part of that due diligence up front.
Gotcha. So it's all about your process and the experience that you had that's helping you with the strategy today.
I would say mostly the systematic process that I'm using right now. I think that's the biggest part of it.
Can you dive in a little bit more on that systematic process?
Sure.
What does that mean?
Let me see. I got a bunch of notes here.
Okay. I love it. Love it.
Yeah, I promise not to go into too many. I'm actually building my own model right now for it so I can help other with it. But yeah, let's see, just some big examples here. Yeah, the market segmentation is very big. The beachhead selection, total addressable market, persona, getting back to all the people that you're meeting with. Value proposition is pretty big. And I think a value proposition is going to be, it's going to change as they move through. So this process is it's supposed to be very much iterative also. So with the value proposition, it gets into asking if the way I do my price point for my products is how much value am I providing based on how much money they are paying me. So our value proposition right now is pay us a dollar, we're going to give you $8 back in value. So
based on I love that.
Being saved and So, but as far as the next part is, I'm not going to go into every single one of these, but I'll just do a quick plug again also for Bill's book. Discipline Entrepreneurship is very good. Takes you through a very systematic process of evaluating an entrepreneurship opportunity. But something else I've actually added into Bill's framework is some of the systems engineering methodologies that I've learned and used in my past as well. So
can you give us an example of that?
Let's see, example of which part?
You were saying the disciplinary entrepreneur. Yeah, give us an example of that.
Actually, my company right now is something I'm using it on. So we've actually taken our business through the entire process, and we're at the point of actually looking at fully developing the product. Now we're at the point where we're ready to invest capital in real code. I think one of the biggest things is, at least in my opinion, is not to code up front. Unless you have a coder on staff and they can just go with it and no problem. But if you're going to end up paying for the code on the back end, I think it's important to ensure that you do that due diligence up front. So
yes, I 100% agree with that. So many founders that I've come across that have spent, like, I don't know, over a year and I don't even know how much money to code everything, and they get to a point where they're finally launching out into the market and they realize that whatever they built out actually has no value in the market. And it's just like, right, you flush down so much resources, and it's so easy to test your concept with just design and talking to people, as you mentioned, like doing interviews. So I think we have so much alignment in what you're sharing and our approach to innovation and technology as well.
No. Really, right? Like, you guys are, I think you guys are UI UX experts. And I'm anything but that, I swear. But I was able to build an initial GUI for my product, the click-through strawman GUI that effectively showed the value that I could provide customers. So every time I meet with folks, this is something that they can actually get in their hands and play around with. Say, look, that's really cool. I absolutely need that. And they click through it and, hey, this isn't that great. Can you, you know, that kind of iteration, I think, is invaluable. And what did it cost me? Like $10 a month to subscribe to software that I can build a GUI on instead of like a product, and then, oh my God, no one likes it. And now what? So
exactly. And one of the themes that you have mentioned throughout this interview is how you create value, right? And you said for every dollar that you're saving, for every dollar they're spending, you're returning $8 back in value to them. And I think that's so important for entrepreneurs to understand, like, what is the actual value of the product that you're building out? Is it just a vision that you have, or are you saving people money? Are you making people money? Like, what is that value and how do you calculate it?
Right. And there's also intangibles too, right? So that's like a quantified value proposition. But the intangibles in my world are like team morale, as an example. You know, if there's like a decision that's taking days to make, that can take a toll on team morale. But if you have like an intensive analytics platform on the back end, helping you solve these data intensive problems and proposing solutions, what that does is it effectively helps facilitate that dialogue. And that's why we call our company Dash 2. Dash 2 is, in aviator term, that's your wingman, right? So if you see two jets, that's what Dash 2 is. We're not necessarily looking at replacing the human being, but rather we want to be there to provide that sense of comfort of knowing, look, if something pops, if something goes wrong in your project, we have your back, right? So we have triggers built in our algorithm. So what will happen is they'll get a user notification of here's what's wrong, here's where it's wrong, and by the way, here's my proposed solution to help you solve this. So it helps streamline that process. So
that's a really cool name. I love hearing about how founders came up with their company's name. So that's pretty cool. Let's dive in a little bit deeper to Dash 2 Labs. Like, if you can tell us what it is, how you decided that it's time for you to be out of the military world and start this company.
Yeah, so this whole stakeholder analysis or market surveys, interviews, it actually started about 3 years ago as kind of a side project. So when I was working in project management, program management, I kept experiencing the same things. And that was data silos, bad data aggregation, multiple software platforms, manual health monitoring of your project, manual data solving of problems. And that was a really big pain point for me. So that's when I decided, look, it's time to like go out into the market and try to fully understand this. And maybe it's just me, who knows? But that's when I went out and started to realize that there's actually trends that are building here, not only in aerospace, but in utilities, in construction, in you name it, any kind of project management. So at that point, I was working for General Atomics. I started the project before General Atomics and then started working for General Atomics. So this was when I was at MIT. and then bridged over to Los Alamos. And I spent about a year there managing one of the nuclear weapon programs. And I decided, look, I was driving about 90 minutes each day. It's a beautiful drive, and it's a really fantastic facility. But I figured, look, it's time to break off and give this thing a shot. So that's when I decided to go full time on it. December of last year is when we incorporated. So
That I love that. And is it made for anyone who needs help with project management, or can you dive in a little bit more about like what the actual product does, the AI?
Sure. Yeah. That's a great question. It goes back into understanding the customer and markets, right? So somebody that's doing a landscaping project in the backyard can't use this. I mean, they can, but it's not worth it, right? So it's understanding what specific niche market is going to be able to use your product and can you scale from there. For us, it's complex project management. Mm. So that can be Navy shipbuilding, modernization, nuclear weapon programs. It could be aerospace projects, unmanned aerial vehicle assembly integration, rocket assembly and things like that. Basically, any kind of complex project that has like tons of variables where right now humans think, yeah, I can keep track of it, no problem. And I have my PowerPoint and then my Excel file. It's just really tough.
So it's not really for the average Joe. So anyone building rocket ships, basically.
Right. So it's basically very complex projects where there's lots of resources, big schedules, lots of people, big budgets and things like that. So that's how we kind of like segmented into it. And another big thing with that is like data infrastructure. Something you have to ask yourself is like, is data infrastructure available? Is it established within an industry? I was initially targeting manufacturing, but when I really evaluated the manufacturing space, the data infrastructure just wasn't there, like in a mass market. It would have been very much a one-off job, very customized and not really venture scalable. So that's when I decided to pivot and say, look, let's go back into like more complex project management. In fact, that's the core of knowledge anyway. So what we found there were, it goes back to voice of the customer. What software products are these folks predominantly using? That way you can look at targeting and building REST APIs on these and absorbing data and then running it through our analytics. So that's kind of how we like narrow it in. As a pilots out there will understand this. It's kind of like a glide slope. You have a runway here and a glide slope, and you want to be on glide slope all the way down to the runway. Sometimes you're below glide slope or above.
What is a glide slope?
It's basically it's a path to the runway that we usually use.
Okay.
And it's one form of landing an aircraft, but in my mind I'm thinking, okay, let's try to stay on glide slope all the way down the runway where you get, you know, full market traction and you're really taking off. A lot of this process, as you probably well know, is very iterative. You're above glide slope or below it, and you just got to do some course corrections to ensure you get down to that runway. So that's kind of how we drove it, right? It's based on customer voice of the customer and the market, and then evaluating that with tech development. So that's how we ended up on complex project management.
Gotcha. So who are your customers now? Like, who do you target? Who are you building Dash2 Labs for at the moment? You mentioned like high complex projects, but I'm curious, like, if there's a specific market that you're targeting.
Yeah, so right now we're looking at aerospace specifically, unmanned aerial vehicle assembly, rocket assembly and such. Something else that we're also interested in is Navy ship modernization and maintenance. And we're actually we'd like to pursue an SBIR with the Navy on that to help with it. Not only because it's a perfect opportunity to fill the software for it, but we've actually lived it and breathed it. And we've been part of that where there's a ship that's, you know, in port and it's delayed in maintenance and the guys out at sea can't come home until the ship goes back out to sea. And I've been on both ends of that.
Oh, wow.
Where you can't come back home or you're in port and you're just frustrated because you just want to get going. So
just changing topics a bit. You also have experience managing large scale programs. I saw that you're involved in 38 projects and a volunteer force of over 2,300 personnel. So my first question is, did you get any sleep during this period? And how did you manage such a large workforce?
Yeah, so that was, we were actually in port with one of the aircraft carriers that I was on. They were performing maintenance on it. And usually the ship's captain will give out the three top priorities. One is to get the ship, at that time anyway, one was to get the ship ready to go back out to sea. The second priority was to get all personnel qualified to ensure that they were ready to go out to sea. And the third one was to contribute as much as we could to the city of San Diego as we can. We're there. We're from all over the U.S. in some cases, all over the world. And something that the Navy tries to do is give back to the community in which we're residing in. So that's where I kind of came in. One of the departments was having a tough time with one of the directives. I think it was about a 6 month. They gave them 6 months to perform about 30,000 hours of volunteer service hours to the city of San Diego. And that was a massive undertaking. And they're a solid team, but they didn't have any like real experience or background in large scale project management. So they said, hey, John, don't you do something like this? And I said, I guess so. So I decided to, hey, let's give these guys a hand. Let's see what we can do. And we evaluated it. And what I found was I could not do this myself, like you had mentioned. That's where it comes, like management and then leadership comes into play, where you actually have to build a team around you that can actually execute these projects, not only with you, but, you know, when you're not there, they can actually act in your place or even manage themselves. So what I did was I took a step back and asked, okay, who's available? Who's interested in doing this? And I had a few officer friends of mine, and we had a senior enlisted personnel and a couple of enlisted guys as well, lower ranking enlisted guys. So what I did was I used a systems engineering approach on that to actually speed the process up of training them in formal project management. So with that, we spent a few days doing that, answered questions. And when you really break it out, it sounds very simple, but if you look at a process and you're like, yeah, that makes sense. But know in the back of your head, something's there. If you just map it out on a whiteboard, the actual process flow, you start to see what I call, or in systems engineering terms, emergent effects. When you're actually making a transition between process steps, and then you start to realize, wait a second, I'm missing something here. Like, you know, you're executing a project, 1,000 people, but what about bathrooms? Something as simple as that could be left out. So we were able to streamline the process of training these folks in a understanding and managing these large scale projects. And our first project was around 1,000 people. And that was one day and lots of really great work in a park in the area of San Diego that really needed it. But overall, we were able to execute about 38 projects, save the city of San Diego over $1 million. And I think we ended up getting around 31,000 volunteer service hours at the end of that time period that Kathy recommended or requested. So it was great. We had a whole thing on the carrier flight deck. The mayor of San Diego came out and declared December 9th as, I guess I can say it, 'cause it's probably out there, USS Theodore Roosevelt Day. The sailors who were involved not only got to contribute back to the city of San Diego, but say, hey, look, I did all these volunteer hours. Maybe you can help me with promotion as well. So there was a lot of intangibles that went into it and came out of it. And it was a really great effort.
Wow. It sounds like a really great effort, especially getting in over 30,000 volunteer hours. That's incredible. And so in terms of systems engineering, I guess, you know, I'm looking at it from a viewpoint of a new project manager, like a young project manager. So for one, it sounds like your approach would be to map out what is the flow of the process and understand where there might be inefficiencies and missing steps that needs to go into building out a process. But what advice would you have for that project manager who now has to take this process and system and implement it and execute it and make sure that people are following through with these processes? Because there is a lot of like monotony in managing through that, through a project, right?
Right. If it's a novice project manager, I would, I'd recommend, there's something called the Project Management Institute, and they provide like formal training and certifications. That's a pretty good way to at least understand the methodology if you're looking to go that route. If not, what we found, about 40% of the PMs that we interviewed were not trained at all. In fact, there was a lot of on the job training. So if there is going to be on the job training, in fact, I talked to a CEO yesterday, and I guess it depends on what the need is, right? He had a relatively smaller firm. And said, look, we're managing through Excel files. There's no standardized methodology that's prevalent throughout the organization. We just kind of let them go with it. I think that works in a smaller environment, but when it gets into like a scale factor, right? When companies start to scale, then you need more standardization, you need more standardized methodologies, you need version control. things like that, communication structures to keep everyone on the same page from a leadership perspective. But getting back to that junior PM, I would highly recommend that that junior PM actually shadow a more senior PM who's been there and done that. That's one of the things that we're trying to address through our technology, actually, is that project management as a whole has been a very, it's just ripe for innovation at this point. It's very human driven, human based, prone to human error. And what we're trying to do on with my company is take a lot of that out. That way the human can actually focus on the bigger strategic level picture of how the project is actually being executed, instead of having to like every day trying to find data here or data there or worrying about how my project is doing. So, but yeah, sorry, back to your question. Shadowing a senior PM is critical at this point, because a lot of it is the bruises that you actually get by executing projects. So
it sounds to me that what you're saying is there's a big market for project management, for AI to assist in helping people manage projects, right? So what would you say, or how do you see the future of this space and market?
Coupled with technology, for sure. I think like a lot of sectors, specifically with PM, when you look at automation, there's dull, dirty, dangerous, and data intensive. What we're focusing on is the dull tasks and the data intensive tasks. So the dull tasks, we're looking at manual data retrieval. That's costing companies around 2,600 hours per year per team of 10. And that's the average team size.
Wow.
Yeah, that's only basic data retrieval. So about an hour a day. And as far as data intensive tasks, we're looking at around 4,000 hours a year for that same team structure. So about 6,600 hours a year based on just data intensive problem solving and the mundane data retrieval. When you really evaluate project management, there's so many areas for innovation. Like you look at email as an example, that's a big thing. What is that email? Where is that email from 6 months ago or whatever the case is? Or can this thing actually be smart enough to set up meetings for you if it recognizes that? These are just some examples of that. So that's, AI is absolutely, and machine learning is going to be very big. One thing to be aware of, as I think in any space, is data availability. How clean is the data? How big are the data sets? Do they have historic data? Because a lot of firms we talk to don't have that robust historic data set. So it is going to be a lot of, before we can run or even fly, we have to learn how to crawl first. And
Yeah, that's definitely a challenge that I see as well within our company, just trying to collect clean data, but also with our clients too. Like, either they don't have the data at all, or it's just a huge headache for us to try to collect that data ourselves. And I'm curious what advice you would have for people who are new to data, how we can be a little bit more efficient in collecting good, consistent, clean data.
Yeah, I think it gets back to your data infrastructure, right? So when you look at your management team, ensuring that your managers have something in place like baskets in which they can collect data. As an example, if you're using, any kind of large scale software package, just ensure that version control is a very big thing. And one person is the center node of collecting that data and updating it. Otherwise it's like anything, it's garbage in, garbage out. And I think that whole garbage in, garbage out could be said of anything. It could be like an advanced analytics platform all the way down to manual data retrieval and presenting it. You can make the argument like, what if this guy's just giving me bad data, right? That's still garbage in, garbage out, but on a slower basis.
Yeah.
So it's a data infrastructure. So if it is a small firm just starting up, smaller firms, I think can get away with, being a little more flexible. But as companies scale, I think it's very important to ensure that you have that data infrastructure set up for a variety of reasons.
Of course. And I'm curious because, as you just said, garbage in, garbage out. What I was thinking was, is it better to have garbage data, but having your team, stay with me here, but having your team exercise that process of collecting data and making decisions based off of that data? Or would you say that's just horrible altogether? Decisions should not be made based on poorly collected data?
I guess it depends on the decision, right? I think a lot of decisions are, they're going to be human based, but if it's a data intensive problem, or if it's like a very high stakes like which market should we attack next, and how much capital and time are we going to be pouring into this, then that due diligence, I think, is going to be very important up front. But if it's more of like, hey, guys, you know, what color should this feature be, or whatever the case is, ideally you have a lot of data or they can drive you to the best optimal color. But if not, hey, it's something that you can just put in there and then iterate, you know, based on user feedback. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. So John, we've got about 5 minutes left. I'm curious if there's any other topics or advice or experience you'd like to share with our audience.
Well, I guess the biggest thing that I've seen with I think startup founders, specifically technologists, engineers, and such, is it's all managing that risk, right? If you're looking at going to market with a product, ensure that you minimize that product market fit risk up front with all that due diligence that we talked about throughout this podcast. And if you're like, where do I find this information? There's tons of books out there. Get some mentors. There's lots of really, really good mentors out there. That way they can help move you through the process of identifying that persona, that niche market area, identifying a viable financial opportunity. And again, value creation, value proposition, customer willingness to pay, strategy involved in that, all this goes into it before you actually go boots on ground and start building something up. So I think that's a big piece of advice for at least from the design thinking side of the house.
I love it. I think that's such a great advice to share with everyone. So John, if anyone wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to find you?
Sure. So my email's, actually, I'm not sure if you have this posted or not, but it's jchrndz@-2labs.com, or you can just go to our website, www.-2labs.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn, so I'm always happy to connect.
Awesome. And we'll put those links down below. Thank you so much, John. We learned so much from you. And if there's anything that we can do to help you in your journey, please let us know.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to our latest episode, and we would like to invite you to check out our other episodes for more thought-provoking discussions and inspiring stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media @WanderStudio and listen to a new episode every week.